This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Later on this edition of Ozarks, a trip to Paris, Arkansas to see and hear an amazing bell collection. Some of the bells will be included in a family chapel being built there. Plus, a merging of spirituality and concern for the environment takes root with interfaith power and light. But we begin with a story postponed from yesterday.
Earlier this year, nearly 90 undergraduate students at the University of Arkansas received Student Undergraduate Research Fellowship Grants, or SURF grants. They award up to $2,500 to be used by undergraduate students for research. This week, several of the students and the faculty members working with them will be profiled on Ozarks at Large. Each of the students we'll meet this week is in the Honors College at the University of Arkansas. And the series begins with Joseph O'Neill, a senior majoring in horticulture in the Dale Bumpers College of Agricultural, Food, and Life Sciences.
You notice we have a whole bunch of vials right here, and these are what I start off with.
Joseph O'Neill is standing over a display of tiny ants mounted inside a case. He spent many hours as an undergraduate making sure these ants, collected in the Ozark Wild, are properly identified.
And so it's basically, we have a collection number and usually about 5 to 30 or 40 ants a vial. And so I try and do these like about 20 or 30 ants a day at this point. Some of the PhD students can do like 100, 200 in like an hour. I just could never imagine that.
The insects are the subject of his Honors College research at the University of Arkansas. He's collecting, mounting, and identifying the ants as part of his senior thesis. But the research he's conducting is expected to have life beyond his own academic responsibilities. Ants, especially ants in the Ozarks, haven't been cataloged as much as other animals. There's no definitive field guide for the ants of Arkansas or the Ozarks. It's hoped the work Joseph is doing will help other researchers in the future. Ashley Dowling, an assistant professor of entomology at the University of Arkansas, is working on a biodiversity study of the area and will advise Joseph as he works on the project. Ashley Dowling says field research he's done with students so far has produced more than 40 specimens of ants in the state. And about a quarter of those, he says, have never been officially recorded in Arkansas before.
And this was just from casual collecting, sort of randomly identifying stuff. And so I suspect with Joseph's project that a huge portion of what he finds will just be new records for the state, just, you know, so at least everyone knows it's here and we can get that out there so distributions and things are well understood.
Collecting ants in the field is just the beginning. Hundreds, thousands of the small animals are put into vials. Then Joseph sorts the ants. It's a process that is methodical and often, because of the size of the specimen, requires more than just the human eye.
You basically put this small needle through this very small piece of paper and then put a little tiny bit of glue on that piece of paper and get it precisely on the side of the ant. And so it's a very delicate process. Like I often have to look through a microscope just to be able to point the right place.
To get an idea of how small the scale is for this work, turn your computer's keypad to a 5-point font. That's the lettering used to ID the ants.
I can't drink coffee before I go in. I have to make sure to bring my glasses. I can't be tired. I have to be, like, if you accidentally touch an ant leg with a needle, sometimes they'll fly halfway across the room almost. So it's a very, very delicate process.
The microscope he uses helps him differentiate between species. He says there are certain characteristics that make it relatively easy to separate the larger families of ants. But to separate species, it takes an experienced eye. It could be where a body part is attached or the placement of small hairs on the ant's body. Dr. Ashley Dowling, faculty advisor for Joseph's thesis, says the Honors College at the university allows student and instructor to collaborate in a mutually beneficial atmosphere. Students can often gain one-on-one guidance, and professors can receive an intellectual boost as well.
It's exciting. Well, the first time I met Joe was in my introduction to entomology course, and you know, he was just this horticulture major that was in there, which most of my course is made up of horticulture and crop science. Entomology doesn't have a major, so I get a lot of students who are there because they have to be there. And so, you know, Joseph came into the class, and after a couple of weeks, we realized, oh, here's someone who's interested in insects, and so let's see how interested he is and how much we can get him hooked. And it didn't take long at all. And it's nice because it allows you to sort of go into more detail with students that are interested.
The senior project for Joseph O'Neill is in the beginning stages. There are many more hours to be spent inside identifying ants and outside collecting them. But already, O'Neill says this very process has led to conversations with other students that have drifted away from ants and into philosophy, other sciences, and other subjects. Joseph says that manner of interdisciplinary discussion is what makes honor college classes actually easier for him.
When you get students who care together with faculty who care, you don't have to worry about the busy work as much, I think it is. And so they're always... It's not as if the subject matter isn't challenging. It's just they're always easier because you're not worried about the little stuff as much. And so the Honors College is really fun because, you know, we get a lot of people from different backgrounds together and get to do more than just focus on our major. You know, we get outside of that and see how our major is cross-discipline. And especially I think that's, like, what makes a successful student, like, you could be an expert in one area, and then if that one area is not needed anymore, you're not going to do much. Whereas, like, if you can take the skills you learn in area A and apply it to area B, you're going to be successful no matter what happens in life. And so I think the Honors College kind of provided that.
Student and instructor plan to meet at least once a week as the project continues. Professor Ashley Dowling expects to have a hands-off approach to his role, but to give Joseph the tools to run with his curiosity. Because the research and identification of ants in Arkansas is a relatively new endeavor, there is a good chance some of Joseph's work will earn him recognition in future studies, or at least mentions in future ant literature. That's a nice potential bonus.
Having my name in something would be nice, but it's more so just, like, there's a lot I don't know that I'd love to know. And it gets me outside, which is always really nice.
And his research could have immediate and perhaps longer-lasting effects. Much of his work will be used by the website AntWeb, where an Arkansas page about ants will be greatly influenced by his work. And after graduation, he plans on joining the Peace Corps.
So I've been gearing up for that, and I think pest management would be a nice thing to have to help develop developing countries, you know, maybe help them with their insect populations and whatnot.
And tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, another undergraduate student at the University of Arkansas who has received a SURF grant to conduct research. Our series will continue throughout the week.
This is Ozarks at Large. Ahead, churches consider energy. Interfaith Power and Light takes a spiritual approach to the environment.
And also ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large, a trip that Antoinette and I took to Paris, Arkansas to meet Bob Cowie and find out why he has
a lot of bells.
More than 70.
Yes, because he counted quite a few of them, and at least that many, I think, is what he said.
And bells from the 18th century, the 19th century, the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. And then different sizes.
We'll find out about that later on Ozarks at Large. Also coming up on Ozarks at Large, your chance to win two tickets to the opening concert Thursday night of the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, also called SONA. Today is the Ides of March.
It is.
So our trivia question today is about...
the Ides of March.
No, Caesar salad.
Oh.
But that's coming up later. So do your research about Caesar salad, and we'll ask that question later. Last night, Antoinette, you went to the Harvard Glee Club?
Yes, Ithi and I went to the Harvard Glee Club at the Arend Arts Center, and it was really fun. There was around 60 members, and it was just amazing to hear all of those voices sort of blend together into this one great sound. And they sang everything from classical works to, like, the Harvard fight song.
I guess I don't know the Harvard fight song.
I did not either, but it was quite amusing.
And this morning, you actually waited in line for Dalai Lama tickets.
I did. I should have got them sooner, but I waited till the last minute, as I tend to do, and got there around 9, and there was a pretty decent line, but I got tickets, and so I'm happy about that.
This was at Walton Arts Center?
I was at the Walton Arts Center. Mm-hmm.
And there was a long line?
I mean, it wasn't huge, but there was a good, maybe about 20, 30 people in line. Right. And I'm sure people were ordering on the phone, and God bless their hearts. The people in the box office were so calm about everything, just nice and orderly. So I think everybody had a good experience.
That event is May 11th.
May 11th.
And I guess if you have any more questions, if you want to know if there are any tickets still left.
Right. You can go to waltonartcenter.org or call 443-5600.
All right. This is Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. Concerns over climate change, rising oil prices, and limited energy resources have brought many diverse organizations together. Student groups, political entities, and business coalitions have formed to address energy use, and so have churches. Our energy correspondent, Christina Thomas, reports on how faith and concern about the environment have merged here.
The local chapter of a national organization is bringing together spirituality and sustainability in an effort to raise green awareness through the faith community. Mac Mayfield, co-chair of Arkansas Interfaith Power and Light, explains a bit about the background of the organization.
It began in California about 12 years ago, and it was an effort to bring green renewable energy to churches. And if you'll remember, California had some problems with energy, and they had to shift their mission a little bit. But since then, it's grown. It's Arkansas was the 30th chapter. Its mission statement is to be its people of faith, working to combat climate change and for the environment. And that's a pretty general mandate, yeah. But that's what we do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it seems that the politicians are having a hard time getting energy policy right. I remember 1973 when they had the Arab oil embargo, and things have not changed that much since then. And the economy has not been able to get the incentives right to get us onto renewables. So take a crack at it from a theological and moral standpoint. Mm-hmm. So that's what we try and do. And involved in, as in caring for creation, you know, if you read Genesis, the first, some of the first words are have dominion over the earth and take responsibility for it is how I hear that call. And so we're trying to do that. Advocating renewables and energy efficiency, and do that in churches and for the congregants. And then there's the issue of social justice. The impact, energy is very regressive in terms of its impact on people and their costs. People have to choose between heating and eating. What a terrible thing in this day and age. So Arkansas is the 30th chapter. We started getting organized in 2009, end of 2009. Last year, we did a lot of housekeeping, got our 501c3 paperwork. It was a very active group down in central Arkansas and now up here in northwest Arkansas.
The chapter received a grant that has enabled them to hire an Arkansas Energy Corps member, helping them carry out their mission. For member Karen, the opportunity is perfect, combining two of her strong interests, spirituality and sustainability.
Really kind of combines two very strong interests of mine, that of the whole spirituality part, as well as sustainability. And so, you know, I felt really fortunate in being able to have this position offered to me and to take it further. And, you know, so it's really allowed me the time and motivation to really study those two things more in-depthly than I had been in the past. So it's a great opportunity. So, you know, it's been a great thing for me. I've been reaching out to churches, contacting different churches and talking to whoever will talk with me, facilities managers, but people on social justice committees. If there's anybody in their congregation that is interested in any kind of green issue, those are the people that I've been talking to. And just trying to help churches get motivated to implement that whole responsibility that churches have in terms of caring for creation and implementing in a way that is tangible and really kind of looking, helping churches look at becoming more energy efficient and better yet how to implement renewable energy at their churches, at their facilities, as well as with individual congregants, that this Interfaith Power and Light is not just talking to churches, the facility, but churches as a whole, that the church as well as the congregants in the church. So it's a all-encompassing kind of message that we bring.
Though Karen's professional background is not in energy efficiency, it has always been a part of her life.
I grew up in Hawaii, where care for the land is such an integral part of my upbringing, that whole part of aloha aina, the love of the land, is something that is sort of, it's in my blood. And so that when I talk about caring for creation or caring for our land, I come from it from a personal, very much a personal point of view, that we really need to take care of the land, that it has taken care of us, we need to reciprocate in taking care of the land. It has given so much to us, and we need to passionately care for it.
For Mac, his interest is both professional and personal.
Well, I'm an engineer, so I do have that energy efficiency background, and I really think that back in 73, when I couldn't get home for Thanksgiving because there was no oil, it really impacted my outlook on the world. I couldn't believe that something as basic as gasoline was so precarious. And it really influenced what I've done over my career. I've always been interested in energy efficiency.
While listening to Karen and Mac, a shared theme or passion can be heard: caring for creation. And those are just the words that they are trying to spread.
Glad to be able to make my my spirituality and my profession kind of meet up. It's not something I'd had a chance to do before. I'd always been interested in the environment and interested in religion and a Christian. It was Interfaith Power and Light that really helped me sort of cross those two paths. And I think that it's a basic caring for creation, leaving the world better than we found it. Those are really tenets of Christianity, to my way of thinking. And I'd never been able to connect to those in the church, but found it through this organization and a group of people that were really committed to that, and it sort of feeds on itself.
The number of churches in the area and the country is astounding. All of those buildings must be heated, cooled, and lit up. The energy savings potential is huge.
There's 300,000 churches in this country. The average is about 10,000 square feet. So that adds up to millions of square footage of buildings, and it's all taken care of by volunteers, or a large percentage of it is. So there's a lot to do there in terms of internal housekeeping. And it's not just energy, it's waste, and we seem to have a lot of energy in the congregations that we've talked to about recycling, mm-hmm. Not using styrofoam, composting the coffee grounds. A lot of coffee gets drunk at church, and some gardener will be glad to take that home and amend their soil with it.
On a local level, Interfaith Power and Light visits churches and attempts to find members that are already interested in sustainability and uses them as a tool to form green teams within each church.
We're looking actively for other people in the community who are in churches who might be the recycling Nazi, or, you know, the people who are thinking about those things. It's a sort of a odd calling sometimes, and so we're searching for the green teams in churches. I go to St. Paul's, and we've had a very active green team for several years. That's where a lot of the energy for Interfaith Power and Light comes from. It's already out there in the congregations. We're trying to help network those and share best practices and get the word out.
Interfaith doesn't limit their outreach to traditional faith groups, but also reaches out to all denominations. Karen shares a recent success story.
This past weekend, I gave a presentation to some Quakers from Oklahoma and Arkansas, and there are about 40 in the group, and we talked about the moral responsibility and how that connects with Quakerism, as well as sort of the nuts and bolts of energy efficiency. In many ways, I thought I was going to be talking to the choir, because, you know, I think about Quakers as being cutting edge, already into that simplicity and all that stuff, and yet still some of them had a lot of questions about, you know, energy efficiency and just the basics of it. And so we talked about that. I have confidence that a lot of them are going to go home and start doing some stuff.
The ultimate goal for MAC and Arkansas Interfaith Power and Light is to bring a different outlook to energy efficiency. A moral standpoint rather than an economic one.
To waste energy is really sinful because of the great costs that it takes, whether it be monetary or on the environment or on people. So to be good stewards is so important, and that's what we seem to have lost sight of. A lot of it goes back to economics. You know, if you were to take the portion of the defense budget that defends, that takes care of the Middle East and protects our oil supply, gas would cost $5, $6, $7 a gallon. And people would treat it completely differently. So trying to bring that moral component to all of that is really important, because it's not just economics and it's not just politics. It's what kind of world will be here in 100 years. You know, if we do as much damage in the next 100 as we've done in the last, our children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren will have a much poorer existence as a result.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
Christina Thomas reports on energy issues for Ozarks at Large through support from Energy Corps. KUAF offers several different signals for you to enjoy and even more ways for you to enjoy them. You're probably well aware of 91.3 FM broadcast, but we offer two more signals, KUAF2, an all-classical music channel, and KUAF3, a channel devoted to news and talk programs. These signals, as well as a digital version of our FM broadcast, can be heard a number of different ways. Tune in with any HD radio or internet radio, listen online with the new KUAF pop-up player, listen on the go via your Android phone with the NPR News app, or with the new KUAF iPhone app for iPhone and iPod Touch users. More information is available at KUAF.com. KUAF, giving you the programming you want, any way you want it.
And mark down Saturday, March 26th, for a couple of interesting events taking place at Lake Fort Smith State Park. That afternoon, that's a week from Saturday, that afternoon from 1 until 3, snake handlers Brad Birchfield and Jeremy Sloan will be on hand for a free presentation in the Visitor Center. It's going to include a slide presentation, live snakes, and a snake hike. That's the afternoon of the 26th. Then that night at Lake Fort Smith State Park, you can explore the night sky with the Arkansas-Oklahoma Astronomical Society. A previewing program begins at 6 that evening. Then binoculars and telescopes will be used to view numerous deep sky wonders, such as open clusters, globular clusters, bright nebulae, and galaxies. For more information about either the snakes or the sky, you can call 369-2469. This is Ozarks at Large.
If everybody had an ocean across the USA.
Michael Love, a member of the American rock group The Beach Boys, was born on this date in 1941. The regional success in 1961 of the Beach Boys' first single, Surfin', led in 1962 to their signing as Capitol Records' first rock act. The Beach Boys soon appeared on Billboard's USA singles charts with such odes to cars and surfing as 409 and Surfin' Safari, while their debut album reached number 4. The follow-up album and single, Surfin' USA, was a commercial triumph in 1963. The group later released the albums Surfer Girl and Pet Sounds. The latter was acknowledged by Paul McCartney as the catalyst for the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. For the remainder of the decade, the Beach Boys issued records of increasing commercial and musical inconsistency. They departed Capitol amid a legal battle over back royalties and signed with Warner Brothers in 1970. Endless Summer, a greatest hits compilation, reached number 1 in the charts in 1974. In 1988, the Beach Boys had a number 1 hit with Kokomo, and the group was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Some of the group's other familiar hits include Fun Fun Fun, Good Vibrations, and California Girls. In the 1990s, the Beach Boys continued to tour and record. In 1998, the Beach Boys released Endless Harmony, a rarities collection culled from an acclaimed television documentary on the group.
Everybody's going surfing USA.
On this date in 1945, the Walnut Ridge Army Flying School in Lawrence County, Arkansas was decommissioned. But as World War II ended, the U.S. Army Air Forces and the Reconstruction Finance Corporation revived the Walnut Ridge Army Air Field. With the war over, it seemed there would be no more need for so many military aircraft. And since the jet airplane had just been developed, many of them were considered obsolete. The government needed places to store and sell these planes, and Walnut Ridge, an ideal site because of the large land area and large parking ramp, became one such site. An estimated 10,000 to 11,000 warplanes were flown to Walnut Ridge in 1945 and 1946 for storage and sale. Roman dictator Julius Caesar was assassinated by a group of nobles that included Brutus and Cassius on this date, which is also known as the Ides of March, in 44 BC. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Earthquakes, fires, a tsunami, and a nuclear crisis. As Japan searches for the thousands of people still missing, NPR's reporters are there.
There's a huge billboard with all sorts of hand-scrawled notes on saying the names of people that they're looking for, saying, "We're safe, come and find us on the third floor."
The latest on the crisis in Japan, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered, this afternoon from 3 until 6 on KUAF 91.3 FM.
It is Tuesday, March 15th, 2011. Joining us now in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Becca Bacon-Martin, editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
And finally, at long last, the public can today buy tickets for the May 11th visit of the Dalai Lama.
This coming after students had first shot, and then faculty and staff at the university.
And finally, it's our turn. He will be in Fayetteville on May 11th. His visit includes a panel discussion at 9:30 in the morning and a lecture at 1:30, both in Bud Walton Arena. So lots of room for folks. And tickets range from $15 to $30 at the Walton Arts Center box office, 443-5600. And let me tell you about something tomorrow so you can get it on your calendar.
Okay.
Tomorrow, the Art and History of Glassblowing, with Ron Minot at noon at the Shiloh Museum in Springdale. If you've never been, I don't know if they really call them sandwiched in anymore.
I haven't seen that term, come to think of it, for a while.
But they have these wonderful noon lunch and learn things. You can bring your lunch. They'll have dessert and some coffee. And it's just great fun. Lasts about an hour, so you can get back to work, 750-8165.
And I spent an afternoon with Ron not too long ago at his studio in Springdale. And he can really break down how this happens, and it'll be well worth your time.
Really interesting guy. Mm-hmm. All right, that's it.
Thanks, Becca.
Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. Robert Bob Cowie has a few loves that he can talk to you about. Certainly his family, raised in and around Paris, Arkansas. His faith, he's a Catholic deacon and parish administrator at St. Anthony's Church down the highway from his home. His country, too, and his work. He founded Cowie Wine Cellars near Paris and created the Arkansas Wine Museum. And he is also very fond of bells. Bob Cowie is a member of the American Bell Association. This summer, he's scheduled to deliver a talk to that association about big bells. He's using that knowledge to amass quite a collection of historic bells. And part of that collection will be part of a chapel he's building on his land in Logan County.
What we're going to do here is raise this tower up 10 feet. So where the top of that cross is where the bottom of the roof will be. When we put the 10-foot section in, that'll make the main tower 45 feet tall. And there'll be four towers, and I think it's 28 bells in the four towers.
The chapel, still in progress, is a 30 by 16 space with choir stalls, stained glass, and of course, bells.
This bell right here came from Spain, we believe. And it says St. Francis of Gabriel, Ora pro nobis, pray for us, 1727. That's a 28 inch. And this bell on this side came from Scotland, and it was 1780. And it says in Latin, I am the gift of the Duke of Argonne. Doesn't have quite the tone the other one does.
Each part of this chapel has a history, a story that Bob Cowie knows. The portrait of Mother Teresa, the oak beams, everything. Bob and his wife plan to be interred in the chapel as well. But that's not scheduled for some time. Bob has projects to complete, including the chapel. It started modestly. It was to be a 10 by 8 or so chapel, just large enough for morning office and maybe have a couple of moderately sized bells to ring. Then he found a 46-inch bell that he liked. He liked it a lot.
Well, that's going to look dumb. One big one and one little one. So we need something in the middle, you know? And then I thought, well, I have seven children. I'll get one for each of them. That'll give me seven bells. So then we had to make the tower bigger, okay? And then I thought, well, they made a lot of iron bells from 4 inches to 54. Why don't I try to get one of each one? So I enlarged the tower added three more towers and started collecting all the sizes. I still need one to have a complete set, but I don't think anyone can come close to my set right now from the bell collectors that I know in the United States. I know several.
And those friendships with other bell collectors helped Bob begin to find more bells. Fellow bell aficionados heard about historic bells that were being removed or placed up for sale, and they let Bob know about them.
I bought one from a Catholic church in Pennsylvania that was 42-inch bronze. We'll see it after a while. And I bought it from some people from India who, I guess, were tearing the church down, and they were in New Jersey. And I called him and made him an offer on it, and he told me he could get more money on scrap than that. It's okay. I'm Scottish, by the way. And so 3 weeks later, he called me back and says, "You still interested in the bell?" It's over there now.
Over there is a warehouse across the highway from the chapel. Bob built it to store the bells and to work on the ones that will be included in the four towers. Others will be included in a bell museum Bob hopes to open someday. He's not quite sure how many he owns, but an impromptu inventory along one wall of the warehouse offers an example of the collection he's acquired.
20, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, 44, 42, 40. There's 43 right here.
He does know this. He only needs a 50-inch bell to complete the run from 4-inch bell to 54-inch. He's sandblasted several that he already has and had them painted, naming each one after a saint or family member. He's had bells delivered on flatbed trucks, transported a couple home in the backseat of his car. They've come from demolished churches, from retired trains, and decommissioned ships.
That was a river bell on the Ohio River. This one over here, I'll clang it once. This is interesting. They would take this bell. Same company that did the big one on the dock. Okay. They would put this on the boat and go up and down the Ohio River. And on the shore, they built wooden barriers. You know, they had poles in it and boards across. They'd go down and ring this thing, and by the echo off of it, they could tell where they were in the river.
Bishop Taylor has blessed the bells, a ringing ceremony you can see and hear in a video on the Cowie Wine Cellars website. Bob hopes to have the chapel ready for a blessing within a year's time. It will be officially dedicated as the Cowie Family Chapel of St. Anne of the Bells, a nod to the former St. Anne's School that was on the land many years before Bob bought it to build his business and now the chapel. And as much as Bob knows about bells, he has one very big question he'd like answered.
Where is the largest bell in Arkansas? Who has it in its history? And it could be an iron bell or a bronze bell. Bronze bells are more pricey and a little bit higher class. Iron bells are just fine. And I'd like to know where they are. I think I know, but...
but you would like to, I mean...
I want it verified.
If you know the answer or just want to know about the bells or the chapel under construction, you can go to CowieWineCellars.com. Cowie spelled C-O-W-I-E, CowieWineCellars.com. And to hear more about the history of the items in the chapel and to see video of some of the bells Bob owns, you can go to our website, OzarksAtLarge.com.
A new music and festival venue, Osage Creek Performing Arts Center, which is currently under construction, is scheduled to open its gates for the first time July 3rd with a major headline act. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich takes us there.
Osage Creek Performing Arts Center is taking shape on a beautiful 72-acre parcel of land on Logan Cave Road north of Tontytown in Salem Springs. The place is crawling with giant earth-moving equipment, concrete, and dump trucks this sunny and very windy morning. Dust is flying everywhere. The multi-million dollar operation broke ground late last year, and Gregory Smith, owner and developer, says this project is a 10-year-long dream come true.
Well, it was after the purchase of a few different farms joining an original family farm, this natural bowl on the north side, northeast corner of the property, lent itself beautifully to the development of the amphitheater because of the natural bowl setting.
A high mountain ridge will serve as backdrop to the bowl, which slopes towards the west. Patrons will view an east-facing stage.
Yeah, we've got the stage is being finished poured today, and we've got steel coming in about a week and a half. The seats have been ordered out of Australia, and we are all the conduit is in the ground. There's over 4 miles of conduit already in the ground for parking lot lights and stage electricity and so on. So it's moving forward, and obviously weather's cooperating, and we're on schedule.
Osage Creek Amphitheater on a soon-to-be-paved dirt road is in the middle of farm country.
You know, we've had really good support from the neighbors. There's a little bit of opposition because of sound and obviously changing the roads out here. What was once dirt roads is now being widened and paved and so on. On that note, I'll say Benton County Road Department's been wonderful to work with, along with the county judge. And there's pretty positive from everybody around the local vicinity.
Perhaps neighbors will be able to capitalize on the venture, which will bring tens of thousands of patrons starting this summer. More about that in a minute. So who are the architects?
Johnson Trollett Architecture out of Holiday Island, Arkansas, and Tom Johnson, Larry Trollett, and Les Persson have been wonderful to work with. And then Sand Creek Engineering, Tatum Smith Structural Engineering, and on down the line. It's been a conglomeration.
The architects have incorporated lots of sustainable technology.
I'd like to share that all materials, all red dirt, topsoil, everything has been from right here on site. We've not brought in anything other than the waste material from power plants, which is our sand base for around conduit and around pipes and underneath concrete. And what's wonderful about that is it's useless for pretty much anything else, and we are using it all over the place. So also we're using all LED lighting, even in the parking lot. So we're going to make as big of an imprint green as we can, you know, composting and recycling, and I think that there's a lot to share on that for sure, and there'll be a green section of our website as well explaining all those aspects that we do, down to the fact that we plan on growing herbs and so on for some of the vendors and for some of the concessions, which is kind of different.
Culinary herbs. Plenty of free parking will be available across the road. Gregory Smith has also paid his ecological mitigation dues.
It's all part of a farm of 660 acres, so there's unlimited things as to what we can do. On that note, I will say that I've already donated over 400 acres to the WRP program, Wetland Conservation for the Illinois Watershed, as just a buffer zone in the floodplain areas down by the creek. So those areas will always remain untouched.
An artist's rendering of the complex shows a glowing iridescent amphitheater at violet dusk, surrounded by a rainbow of spotlights. Crowds fill terraced seating areas and picnic on soft green grass. A blue water feature pools along the south side, adjacent to food and beverage vending areas. Osage Creek Amphitheater will cost anywhere between $4 and $6 million, including land and road improvement values, all of it private money. Once completed, it will accommodate 12,000 patrons.
Yeah, it's got 5,000 fixed seats, and then there's room on the grass for another 10, 15, but in reality, we're going to cap it at about 12, and there's many reasons for that, but it's intimate as it is, and with 5,000 fixed seats, we can have pretty much anybody in the business come play and know that they can put the overflow on the grass, and that's what's real appealing, and yet not too big.
After this summer, campers, including RVs, will be welcome, rain or shine.
There is some local campgrounds that are going to work with us, already are working with us. They will be up on our website, which is osagecreeklive.com, here shortly. And as far as the VIP areas go, there are 60 corporate boxes and VIP lounge area, VIP parking and things of that nature. And as far as the venue being covered, yes, the artist and, you know, it'll be can levered out over the first little area of seats, but for the most part it's going to be open air, look at the stars, enjoy the show.
Speaking of stars, Willie Nelson will be the grand opening act.
The red-headed stranger from Blue Rock, Montana, rode into town one day, and under his knees was a raging black stag, walking behind was a bay. The red-headed stranger had eyes like thunder, and his lips, they were sad and tight. His little lost love lay asleep on the hillside, and his heart was heavy as night. Don't cross him, don't boss him, he's wild in his sorrow. He's riding, hiding his pain. Don't fight it, don't spite it, just wait till tomorrow. Maybe he'll ride on again.
Yeah, it's Willie Nelson's Country Throwdown with Jamie Johnson and Randy Houser and Lee Bryce, Brantley Gilbert, and a few others, including Lucas Nelson, which is Willie's son, and we're excited about it. It's Sunday, July 3rd, and tickets are available at osagecreeklive.com.
Willie Nelson's Country Throwdown Tour spotlights top music artists and emerging singer-songwriters. The day-long music festival will feature multiple stages and special attractions, and the cost is a bargain. $43 for bleachers, $53 terrace seating, $70 for orchestra, and $95 for VIP. And as Gregory Smith says, there's not a bad seat in the house. Other possible acts for next year, Smith said, could be Dave Matthews, Red Hot Chili Peppers, and Kenny Chesney. Themed festivals will also be staged here.
As far as festivals go, we are permitted for festival grounds across the street in what will be the general parking area. We could do multi-stages and we could do multi-day events, and that is not the focus for the first year. We want to get one good year, work out the kinks, whatever they may be traffic-wise or what have you, but we are definitely looking at moving in that direction in the future. We'd also like to look at the possibility of, you know, maybe a Renaissance festival and doing things like that out here. And Easter Sunrise Service, just all the way across the board, whether it be a Hispanic festival or a Christian festival and Christian shows. And, you know, we want to cater, be able to cater to everybody.
Facilities are also available for private events. In 3 months, when Osage Creek Amphitheater opens its gates, patrons will find it will perfectly fit into a growing entertainment corridor building in Northwest Arkansas, including Crystal Bridges Museum of Art, scheduled to open in November, and a new Walton Arts Center complex in Bentonville. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
If you'd like more information about tickets to Willie Nelson's concert, that will be the premier concert at Osage Creek Performing Arts Center, scheduled for July 3rd, 239-4041. And to learn more about the venue itself, you can go to osagecreeklive.com. That website, by the way, is also still under construction. This is Ozarks Large, and it is your opportunity now to win a pair of tickets to the opening concert of the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, SONA. That opening concert is this week.
It's Thursday at 7 o'clock at Walton Arts Center.
The SONA first program includes works by Penman, Mendelssohn, and Brahms. And this is the question that you'll need to answer. First of all, once again, it is March 15th, the Ides of March. This is the day Caesar was
assassinated
by Brutus and
Cassius.
And about 58 others.
Well, right.
Yes. So that inspires today's question, not that it's about Julius Caesar, but it's about Caesar salad.
Yes.
Which is not named after Julius Caesar.
No.
It is named after the chef Caesar Cardini, who was an Italian-born Mexican who had a restaurant in the 20s, and as his daughter tells the story, one 4th of July was running out of supplies and just put together what he had in the kitchen and then tossed the salad in front of the restaurant customers, who thought it was a novel touch to actually toss it by the side. The question here is, where did Caesar Cardini first allegedly invent the Caesar salad? Which American city? Was it San Diego? Was it San Antonio? Was it Miami? Again, where did Caesar Cardini in the 1920s create the Caesar salad for the first time? Was it San Diego, San Antonio, or Miami? Call right now.
1-800-522-5825.
If it's easier for you to remember, that's 1-800-522-KUAF. You can call from now until the end of the Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor. And this is Ozarks at Large. The answer now to our question before the Writer's Almanac, where did Caesar Cardini allegedly invent the Caesar salad on a July 4th in the 1920s? The choices again were San Diego, San Antonio, Miami. The answer, San Diego. So there you go. Two free tickets to the Sona concert to the person we will pull out. We still don't have anything to pull the names out of yet.
No, we need something. I miss the wooden chicken.
The wooden chicken. Migrated West with PJ Hrabowski when she retired from radio. Two more tickets left for the Sona concert that we will give away tomorrow at the end of Ozarks at Large.
Local support for Ozarks at Large comes from the Jones Center in Springdale, presenting its 7th annual Spring Break Celebration. Youth activities begin on Tuesday the 22nd and run through Friday the 25th. Magic, parade, and tea party, creative fun zone, track and field games, and more will be featured. Information is available at thejonescenter.org. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Havana. Your NPR affiliate for the past 26 years and your source for community events. Remember, you can enter your own community event information at our website, KUAF.com.
Havana, located almost equally between Danville and Boonville.
Good to know.
In Yell County. This is Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
A brand new edition of Ozarks at Large tomorrow at noon on KUAF 91.3 FM.
Have a great Tuesday.